Hi, good afternoon. Welcome to In His Sign and Our Recourse. I'm Brian Gale. It is 4 o'clock on a Monday, March 6th, a beautiful day actually in Philadelphia. We have a great show for you today and a really wonderful young guest, a young president. And I got a chance to know this man on a golf course a couple of years ago and a little bit about his organization, and it is an outstanding one. It's called Pennsylvanians for Human Life, and it is about 47 years old. It started in 1970. It actually predated Roe Wade, and it is the only pro-life organization that is focused on its original mission, which is education, and it sends speakers of all age, every kind and stripe, into junior high and high schools, Catholic and otherwise, to talk about the evils of the culture of death and the assault on life. Of course, it focuses primarily on abortion, but not exclusively. There are end-of-life speakers, euthanasia, infanticide, assisted suicide, biotechnology, and the evils of that as it begins to ramp up in our time through artificial intelligence. There's just an awful lot on that continuum of life that is ever darkening, and Pennsylvania's for Human Life exist to keep the light on. And we are delighted to welcome their young president today. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you for that introduction. I don't think I could have captured the mission statement or the spirit of PHL better. Thanks for having me this afternoon.
Well, it's a delight, and I will just say to our listeners that you and I met on a golf course, and I think it was you that urged me to get to know the organization a little better, and I did. I went to one of your affairs, your functions, and got a chance to meet some of the people. I saw some of the work close up that they do in the classroom. Really outstanding work. And I'd have to say to you, how long have you been involved with Pennsylvanians for Human Life, and what prompted you to sign up for this?
Yeah, I've been involved, and actually, just to back up a step, we actually met on the golf course for a benefit for Generation Life, which actually is in our same building. Their mission is a little bit different, but yeah, that was a wonderful day, and I personally became involved. I did a little bit of an academic odyssey. I'm a hometown boy. I went to Malvern Prep. I then went to Catholic University. I went to the University of Wisconsin to get a master's degree, and then I went to Yale Law School. I practiced in New York for a couple years. And then I came home. I think there's something about the Philadelphia area that I call it the gravitational pull. You can stay away for a while, but sooner or later, the city of brotherly love loves you back. So I came back, and I really just wanted to be involved. I guess the genesis of my philosophy to respect life came from my mother. My mother was an Italian first-generation immigrant. She was raised in West Philadelphia. She always had a devotion to the Blessed Mother. She raised five children. I was the caboose by 13 years. She later became a grandmother seven times over, and she passed about 4 or 5 years ago, which was roughly coincident when I assumed my presidency of PHL. But she always, she loved babies. She loved children. And most importantly, she was a very bright woman, and she was never swayed by, I think, the culture of death, and in fact was in pointed opposition to that. And through her message and her mission, that deeply influenced me. When you're growing up, and we were talking before the show about, the fact that the message is getting through to young people, I was always pro-life. I didn't really waver in that. I'm obviously a lot more committed now in terms of leading the mission in PHL with its challenges, trying to survive financially and getting the message through. But as I said, when I came back to the area, this was probably 2002, I was an attorney practicing in town, but I really wanted to get more involved in getting connected, making my faith and my mission, making an impact with the gifts I was given. My mother was obviously big on noblesse oblige. So I became a speaker probably around 2003. I then was invited to join the board of directors probably about 10 years ago. And again, as I said, I was asked to assume the presidency 5 years ago. And in that time, I mean, I've gone as far north as Father Judge, as far west as John Paul II and Royersford. Mm-hmm. I've had a chance to go into some really great schools, Devon Prep. You got to go back to my alma mater, Malvern, Archbishop Carroll, Goretti, Hallahan. And it was just, it's been a fantastic journey. I was just up at Father Judge last week, actually, doing an all-dayer. And we're certainly glad to have you as a speaker. I do remember my soft sell recruitment in the golf cart, but you've really been a revelation for us as well, and we're certainly glad to have you.
Well, it's great work. You know, being in front of those kids is it's difficult to put into words, but I was stunned at how little they knew, and I shouldn't have been, because I raised my own kids. We have seven kids, and you know, so I've been around a lot of kids for a lot of years. But I was very surprised when I would ask what I thought were basic questions, and the only hand that would go up was the young teacher in the back of the room that would out the answer, and sometimes she was right or sometimes she wasn't. But they are blank slates, and they are there to be fed with truth. And there's no telling, as you said earlier, what can happen when kids, you know, get engaged with the truth and the spirit stirs within them.
Yeah, and that's exactly the point. When you talk about the blank slate, I mean, it's not so much. I mean, I very rarely would say ever had an experience that was confrontational or hostile. I get, you know, the reaction varies from what I call the pleasantly catatonic to kind of the spectacularly uninformed. But, you know, a lot of it depends on, I would say, you know, first of all, I see a lot of difference in single-sex versus co-ed without making a judgment one way or the other. I mean, I went to Malvern, which was single-sex. But I think when you separate the adolescent boys and girls, I think it gives them more of an opportunity and a comfortable atmosphere to really think about these issues. And a lot of what I did, I mean, I've had all kinds of different presentation. Being an attorney, I go more into the constitutional landscape and Roe v. Wade and what led up to Roe v. Wade and its aftermath. But, you know, just again, going back to Father Judge, I mean, I never really did, you know, the life stages. We have a whole presentation on the life stages that, you know, the hands and feet are formed at 12 weeks, the heartbeat begins at 18 days, the neural patterns are forming at 18 weeks, and, you know, the baby models and everything else, and the truth is there. You know, it's incontestable, and I think the reason when you put the truth out there, kids are receptive to it, is because they don't go for head fakes. You know, they haven't had a chance to have the received wisdom from the media, which is it's a woman's body, it's a woman's right, it's a woman, 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 which is not to undercut that, yeah, I always say it is her choice. I mean, I'm an attorney and I have to respect the law of the land, as fallen as I think it is, but we are an educational mission. Shouldn't the woman in this day and age in 2017 with all of our amazing resources be making as fully informed a choice as possible? And that generally, I mean, trust me, it wasn't easy arguing this stuff in the hallowed halls of the Yale Law Journal, but that does get people to think. And I think with the young people, they've been so suffused with one message, which I would say is primarily at bottom, it's a selfish one. The value of my life takes preeminence over the child's life. Or again, as you said, I mean, PHL isn't just abortion focused. I mean, our statement is that all life is sacred from the moment of conception through natural death. So I also do a lot of presentations on physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, but it all goes back to the root cause, which is, you know, privileging your life or the gift of life and arrogating that to yourself rather than being open to the truth of the message, which is you've been given a gift and you can't throw away this gift, I think is just very powerful. And at an early age, it puts kids in touch with the truth and gives them instruments and tools that they don't just have to blankly go along. And I think at my most rewarding experience is, I always say, I try to get, you know, if I change two or three minds, or at least get them to think about it in a 20 to 25 person classroom, I've done my job. But a lot of them are always the kids after the class who might have been nervous to raise their hand or speak up or get made fun of, but, you know, want to know more about Roe v. Wade, or want to know more, you know, about how I got involved, or want to know more about PHL. And that, to me, is the most gratifying thing.
Wow.
You make those personal connections, you know, through the platform of PHL.
What kind of reactions do you get from the teachers?
The teachers have been universally positive, actually. I'll give you one more story that I thought was funny. When I went back to alma mater, it just happened to coincide with my 25th reunion at Malvern Prep. And there was we'll take the space of the theology classes, so we'll probably hit the beach for 2 to 3 days, and we do our message during those class periods. There was a woman who actually taught my nephew as well. And I come in, and I'm flush with pride, and I'm the conquering hero. And the woman had, you know, this kinky hair, and her name, oddly enough, was Jessica as well. That was our student speaker. She had the Harvard background, and I was just, you know, prepared to do battle, because I had seen people, you know, especially, you know, some feminists she reminded me a lot of the women who would be hostile to my message.
Right.
When I was in law school, and midway, I think I was going to something about Roe v. Wade, and midway through, she interrupted me, and I said, "Oh, here we go."
Right.
And instead, what was interesting was I got her full backstory. She had actually been born Jewish, converted to Catholicism, had become a nun.
Oh my God!
Attended Harvard University and considered herself a feminist, but a feminist for life. And as I said before about, you know, giving women the tools to make a fully informed choice, she was actually offended. Not getting into the political, but this whole counter movement against Trump and the march and the women's march, and some women groups weren't invited. It's interesting how those sides get picked, or, you know, how she was objecting to the fact that someone was just taking the position that, well, someone should make my mind up for me, because I'm frankly not intelligent enough or well-read enough to make up my own mind on this issue.
Right.
So it was an interesting twist, but I would say, you know, most of the theology teachers that we deal with, and even the substitutes, have been universally behind us. And in fact, we couldn't get into the schools without their support. And a lot of them are very, obviously if you're teaching theology in a Catholic high school, you're engaged in the message, but they're also very, very pro-life, I've found, in varying degrees, which also helps us.
So a Jewish woman, an ex-nun, teaching at Malvern, interrupted mm-hmm. your class and told you and the class her backstory.
Yes.
That's fascinating.
You can't judge a book by its cover, Brian.
No, you really can't. And I guess she thought, if she wasn't if she was a full-time teacher, I guess she hadn't told the class, pretty much her background, and nobody had introduced her. But you have to wonder the impact of that story on those kids, a conversion, the stirring of what was thought to be a religious vocation, and ultimately the settlement into a lay vocation of teaching truth. I guess this was a religion class, was it not? Theology?
Yeah, it was religion theology.
So she had to go and get a graduate degree, from somewhere, I'm sure, to teach theology at Malvern. What a wonderful odyssey, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it was very interesting. And again, her perspective, but for being hostile to the pro-life message, was, as I said, you know, part and parcel. I mean, this is a brilliant woman, obviously a dedicated teacher. But I mean, I just think the courage to make up your own mind and to, more than that, as you say, convey that message and witness to that for your students, is extremely powerful. And it certainly influenced me when I was there. She wasn't teaching when I was there, but my nephew and you know, when I go back, and you probably get, you know, the same feeling from your friends from Bonner or LaSalle. I mean, there is something to having those institutions, even at an early age, when you don't think the message is going through, but planting those seeds and getting the students to think for themselves. But think for themselves, I think, in a positive way, which, as you say, you know, the pro-life message is not even getting out. Forgetting which side you're taking. I mean, you're just not hearing the side of pro-life. And, you know, I just think that it's just a massively underserved argument. I mean, part of it, too, I mean, when I, switching from my speaker hat to my president's hat, I'm still amazed that, you know, PHL is the oldest pro-life institution in Pennsylvania. It actually predated Roe, as you had said. It's 47 years old. And every year I do the bank. We just had our banquet at Springfield Country Club in late February, and you know, you're sitting at my table, and we were commenting that people still don't know about us, and that, you know, that's a shame. But again, I try to do, if I can adjust one perception, or I mean, you hadn't heard about it, you know.
I had not.
You're Knight of the Immaculate. You have the radio show, but part of it too. I mean, that's not to judge or lampoon people for ignorance. It's more, there are so many groups and organizations that might be politically focused or, you know, take slightly different orientations in terms of the mission. You get lost in the sauce. I mean, I remembered, I wasn't even quite sure when I first came back to the area what the difference between Generation Life's mission and PHL's mission was. But, you know, it's a little bit like the seven blind men and the elephant.
Right.
You know, everyone's kind of going in the same direction, but you just hope that, you know, we're kind of working coordinately as much as possible at the same time.
Well, it was great to see Marge Hoffner's daughter stand up and introduce Michael O'Rourke, who was the awardee. A wonderful young man and a wonderful family, and just a great witness himself. But to see Marge Hoffner's daughter up there introducing this man and talking about, reminiscing about their past, their coming up as children, coming up together, the two families, has told some funny stories. Just a wonderful legacy, huh?
Yeah, no, that was Anita Nardone. She's been a past president for PHL. I think she was about two or three cycles before I was. But Anita's just been a rock. She did the centerpieces, and she's a civil engineer, and just a dynamo. And yeah, it was good for me too, because again, like I said, the organization started with Marge and Peg O'Rourke and you know, all these wonderful, brave ladies who wanted to make a difference a year before I was born. So it was interesting for me to hear that backstory, and that she and Mike, who's been a, you know, just a soldier for us, not just a financial benefactor, but really, it's something I can identify with, want to do, carry on his mother's legacy, and you know, through his own example. It's a rich history. Now, I also always say, you know, as strong as the history is, it's frustrating for me, because I think when they started it, they probably hoped or prayed or didn't think that there would be a need for an organization like ours in 47 years, that,
wow,
you know, the Roe v. Wade and abortion rights would kind of run its course and ebb back. I hesitate to call it the high water mark, but there wouldn't still be a need to educate. And unfortunately, there is, and there is more than ever. I think it's just one of those cultural wars that, you know, you want to educate and you want to be compassionate. But there are lives at stake, you know, and if you just voluntarily wallow in ignorance, you know, to me, you're just further jeopardizing those lives. And to get in early, to plant the seeds early, you know, and there's different ways to do it. They have the 40 Days for Life vigils going on that I'm going to participate in Wednesday, and, you know, the Pro-Life Federation and the Pro-Life Union, and the Pennsylvania Pro-Life. But I think that, you know, the direct action, the education is just about as the least contentious way that you can put the message through and make sure it gets across, at least politically speaking.
Do you have a hard time getting into the schools, even Catholic schools?
I wouldn't say a hard time. I mean, we go in, you know, I don't know if these statistics are dated, but I mean, their metrics are, we get into 100 schools. You know, we reach 60,000 students annually. That infrastructure was up and running way before I hit the scene, and that was just the network of, you know, grade schools and high schools. By the way, neither PHL nor our mission is limited strictly to Catholic schools. Yeah. We do go into public schools. We've gone up to Council Rock, and even though it's mostly in the schools now, we have done, I mean, I did a lecture for Regnum Christi. I've done lectures at the Malvern Retreat House. You know, there are different adult groups, CYO groups, Knights of Columbus, that we've also been active with. So, I mean, we're more have platform, we'll travel. But you know, our mission today, you know, currently is more focused in the schools.
You get into 100 schools a year?
I think at the peak it was 100. We've probably, Martha Schwartz, our executive director, and she's another dynamo. I think we've fallen off that clip, but we're pretty much near that in terms of you know, getting that getting the message across.
And a good number of them presumably are high schools, right?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, some of them, to your earlier point, is there a challenge? I mean, when I became president, I thought it was just a glaring omission that Malvern wasn't involved. And, you know, I heard the reasons why a little bit later, but I was very proud to build those networks. I was just actually at a Malvern event last week, and with the help of Father Flynn and Father Chris Drennan, you know, they welcomed us back with open arms, and it was a very proud moment for me. But, you know, Martha actually handles more of that. She's our, you know, battalion commander to get us in there. But I don't think that there are some schools that we haven't had much success with for whatever reason, and haven't been asked back. But I think by and large, it's a positive experience. And obviously with the Archdiocese closing or merging schools, you know, that becomes an additional challenge as well.
Well, you hear stories and you have to wonder, how could a Catholic school, I'm sure they have their own reasons, but how could they possibly say no to an invitation to an organization like yours, Pennsylvania for Human Life, to come in and talk to their children, their students, about life? Hard to believe.
I don't disagree. Yeah, I mean, well, some of it, I'll tell you candidly, there are some schools that believe, well, you know, we're doing just fine ourselves.
Okay.
I mean, we're equipped to make this a part of the curriculum. I think there are some schools that, again, part of the challenge for us is that as dispassionate as we try to make, you know, sometimes emotions do run high, and, you know, maybe they're strong words get spoken in the classroom, or there are reactions that, you know, a teacher didn't like or an administrator didn't like, and sometimes, again, we won't be invited back. Now, that I don't think is the fault of our speakers, and I've never personally been involved there, but, you know, there, some people just, there are certain things sometimes happen despite the best intentions, and you know, we'll lead. And then, like I said, I mean, sometimes we just try to wait a few years and get back into the game at some of these schools.
Well, I would think that the entire continuum of life is going to be increasingly in play. There's more and more that we read about assisted suicide, and we know that, you know, the healthcare industry in general is under the microscope, and there is a perfect storm brewing out there with the demographic blip that is the boomers now retiring and having, as they say, the big three diseases, the cancer, dementia, and the diabetes. requiring more and more treatment at greater and greater expense. We have, of course, technology developing new means of addressing some of these seemingly insoluble problems, but it's very expensive. And you have these bioethical boards that are now increasingly influencing care decisions, healthcare decisions, life decisions in these hospitals and hospital chains. And a lot of the decisions, no, I shouldn't say a lot of the decisions, but a growing number of the decisions are not in favor of life.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Last year's banquet, which is, I think was the first one that you attended, we had Alex Schadenberg, who's actually a Canadian researcher and activist, who pointed out that a lot of the doctor, I mean, you're also talking a lot of times, as you said, people with dementia, you know, signing their rights over for a doctor to make a decision as to whether or not in the states where assisted suicide, which, by the way, there is a correction. It's now called aid in dying.
I know. I heard that.
As a former English major, I'm as appalled as I am fascinated by the wordsmithing that goes in. You know, I noticed that the pro-life has never changed its terminology, but the pro-choice or reproductive freedom or aid in dying forces do. But yeah, I mean, to get back to the point, I mean, he brought up a lot of statistics that are extremely troubling. And, you know, this is an issue that hits home to me as well, because as I said, you know, my mother died when she was 82. I remember before my introductory keynote in 2012, you know, I was about to go on, and we do a ladies' luncheon every fall at Overbrook Country Club, and, you know, she was recovering from... she was recovering from a heart surgery. Hmm. There was a complication. She died the next day, but it was just a unique moment that we could share that hour. Wow. You know, and that was basically her valedictory before she passed on to you know, inspire me and, you know, rededicate myself to that mission. My uncle has battled some health problems. He's at Bryn Mawr Terrace now, and my father had a heart attack, so. You know, I, as again, one of the benefits of being the caboose was neither my mother nor my father, you know, my mother had her brother, but, you know, I didn't have cousins really, or really grandparents. So I never saw someone close to me die or, you know, kind of progressively fade away until comparatively recently. And, you know, just getting the theology and the facts down, you know, you have the basic working knowledge that, you know, you don't have to do extraordinary means, but as you said, you know, technology is now, you know, the science is always going to outpace the morality a little bit. You know, that happens in a good way with abortion. I mean, you can you know, have these preemies that can live outside the womb at, you know, 18 weeks. But, you know, the flip side of that coin is it's dicey. And I think the need for education in that arena with, as you said, this, you know, ever-expanding boomer population, and what do we do? What guardrails do we put up? You know, and more, most importantly, not just the legislation and the court decisions, but what are we guided are in terms of the moral principles, the bioethics? You know, and it's dicey. I mean, to me, I would say the abortion issue is a little bit more clear-cut. But the assisted suicide, I mean, they're very individually case-based. And as you said, I mean, the technology is creating some probably moral conundra that were probably unforeseen even 5 years ago.
No doubt. Chris, can you hang with us? We have my studio engineer, by the way, is very excited to have you on because he contributes to Pennsylvania for Human Life. He loves the organization. Harry, our engineer, is
keep
signaling.
Keep coming, Harry.
Yeah, he's signaling me that he will. He's telling me we have to break for a commercial. Can you hang with us?
Absolutely.
All right, good. We're going to pay homage, if we can, to a wonderful organization that is the sponsor and has been throughout February and now into March of our recourse on In His Sign Network, Ascension Press. And I'll just point out at the top that St. John Paul II the Great once famously said that he believed the Holy Spirit was more alive in our time than ever before. He said, precisely because the other spirit is more alive in our time than ever before. I don't think too many of us would question that. He said, also, it's sometimes hard to see the Holy Spirit at work in what seems to be a time of growing darkness. But he saw the signs. He talked an awful lot about this new springtime. And there is, in fact, a great renewal of the faith underway in our homes and parishes all across the country. And one might even say that we're seeing something of this new springtime, at least the foundation for it being built that John Paul II talked about. And for the proof, we have to look no further than the great and varied faith formation programs that have sprung up and are now in use all across the country. And the mother lode for all of them began and ends with Ascension Press, a local Catholic publisher, founded by our friend Matt Pinto, a wonderful benefactor of many worthy Catholic causes here in the Archdiocese. But as he states it, the Ascension mission, very simply, is to present the truth and beauty of our faith as the surest path to authentic happiness. A beautiful, simply stated mission. And for the past 10 years, Ascension's been publishing video-based learning systems for small faith formation groups at Catholic parishes, often in the homes. And today there's nearly 40 different learning systems, if you can believe it, being used in literally thousands of Catholic parishes throughout the country. I think there's 13,000 parishes in the U.S., and about 10,000 of them at one time or another have used Ascension programs. And the programs range from the very acclaimed Bible Timeline series, many of you are familiar with, Jeff Cavins, and into church history, to how to pray, to preparation for sacraments, to teen faith formation, to hope and healing for the divorced and separated going through a very hard and dark time in their lives, to the very popular Guide to Virtue program that's been launched recently, and of course the famous one, the Remarkable Theology of the Body series by Christopher West. These programs are changing the lives and families of parishes of Catholics of all ages and backgrounds, and they're quite literally renewing the face of the earth here in America, and at a time when they were never more needed. And now you can get access, Matt tells us, to the videos in these programs for free on Ascension's new digital platform, www.evangelization.com. Very simple, www.evangelization.com. The website also has a host of free tools that will help you run small groups in your own parish or even in your own home. And we can remember fondly that our dear Lord and Savior once promised that where two or more are gathered, there I am. And I would ask you to prayerfully consider going to the Ascension website today to get a good look at all the ways you can enrich your faith and bring Jesus more deeply into the midst of your family and parish. As St. Peter once reminded us, we should always be ready to give a reason for what we believe. And now with Ascension Press, we all can.
My name is Mario Diadamo, and I have been a faithful listener to In His Sign Radio Ministry since 1990, and to Kathleen McCarthy as principal host since 2007. Hearing the witness of Kathleen and her guests has contributed greatly to my spiritual growth. They have educated me about the tenets of my Catholic faith by presenting lay and religious leaders discuss topics that help listeners create an informed Catholic conscience. I always encourage people who are in need of prayer and companionship to listen, call in, and become part of our radio listener family by joining thousands of other people praying for your intentions. I personally can attest to the power of the prayers from the ministry. Kathleen often reminds her listeners that you are never alone because the Lord is always with us. Through this Catholic radio and internet apostolate, the Lord is indeed with us in a very tangible way. Please share the good news as Kathleen takes a leap of faith and expanding to a two-hour program to reach many more people who need to experience the love of God. Thank you.
You're listening to In His Sign Catholic Radio, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. We are blessed to have had this Catholic radio apostolate for almost 40 years now. Thanks be to God for your partnership. Without you, this radio voice would be silenced. We have a monthly Mass offered for you, our loyal family of listeners. It's our way of saying thank you for underpinning our apostolate with your many prayers and financial support. This is your radio ministry, to be a voice for those who have no voice, to evangelize and to catechize for a time such as this. We know the Lord will bless you abundantly. He can never be outdone in generosity. If this ministry has touched your heart, help us to touch other hearts by supporting us with your prayers and financial support. Call us at 610-527-2906 or visit our website at inhissign.com.
Okay, we're back with a wonderful young man, the president of the Pennsylvanians for Human Life, Chris Hushaw. And Chris, I want to, before we pick that conversation back up again, I want to plug, if I can, the 40th anniversary celebration of In His Sign Catholic Radio. I didn't realize it until recently, but this network is actually dedicated to St. Maximilian Kolbe, of course, who was the founder of the Knights of the Immaculate. And October 16th of this year, we'll be celebrating our 100th anniversary. St. Max started the Knights in response to the virulent hatred he saw in the streets of Rome toward the Pope and the Church on the part of the Freemasons. And he really founded the Knights as a counter action, an antidote to Freemasonry. Anyway, the 40th anniversary celebration is going to be on Sunday, April 30, at the Malvern Retreat House, 1:30 to 5:30 on South Warren Avenue in Malvern. The cost per person is only $55. The table for eight is $400. I think it'll be a grand afternoon and a wonderful celebration for a terrific organization, and I commend it highly and ask each of our listeners to please prayerfully consider supporting the network and coming out and supporting it visibly. Chris, wonderful to have you again today. It's been terrific. And before we broke for commercial, we were talking about end-of-life issues. And I wanted to tell you that George Azayo, Dr. George Azayo, a man we both know and admire greatly, told me only about 6 months ago that the word he used was pandemic. He said the problem of end of life and the confusion around what the right and proper decisions are, the moral decisions for people caring for loved ones with respect to food and hydration, basic stuff, if you will. He said the confusion is pandemic. He said, I cannot tell you how many times I inveigh upon a couple not to let the tubes be removed, food and hydration, from their loved one, only to have a priest or a friend or they themselves, their own points of view, telling them that they have complete freedom to do this. And at the end of the day, the most merciful thing you could do is pull the plugs, because mom and dad or whoever that loved one is wouldn't really want to live like this. He said, I am beyond frustrated. I don't know what we can do. But he said, the ignorance is massive, a word you used earlier. And I can only think, as Archbishop Chaput said after the first synod, he said, you know, we all know where confusion comes from. That was the gospel yesterday. He has no truth in him, the Lord said about the cosmic liar. No truth in him. So we see mass confusion among the people of God on an issue like this, end of life, the far end of the continuum. You know, no longer great confusion about abortion, as you said, clear cut. We either know, all of us know the issue so well, we've chosen a position, quote unquote. We know where we stand on that issue. But lots of confusion on the far end of the continuum with respect to what constitutes the moral choice for end of life when there are difficulty, and of course there's various stages of difficulty. How deeply into this issue do your speakers get in Pennsylvania for Human Life?
Actually, I do a lot of presentations on this, Brian. I mean, we're certainly focused on pro-life, but it seems when I do my speaking engagement, I would say about half. And part of it, too, I mean, it's a little bit more relatable for me, obviously, because I'm going through it now. And when I go to talk to the kids, I mean, they, you know, my situation off the table, but most high school kids probably knew an aunt or an uncle or grandpa or nana that, you know, was on these tubes and was in the hospital and at least has some awareness. So it becomes, again, a little bit more relatable and less, quite frankly, uncomfortable than, you know, talking to, you know, freshmen and sophomores of, you know, budding sexuality about pregnancy and abortion. But again, the end of life, part of the confusion, I think, and it was interesting you mentioned Father Colby, because I thought that was just such a profound. I mean, everyone knows him for offering his life in Auschwitz, but his career that predated that, and as you said, it was really a war. And I remember studying his writings last year. Part of the other things my mother did was she was very much into faith and scripture sharing. And we did the Gately series with Louis de Montfort.
Oh, and Morning Glory.
Mother Teresa, John Paul II, and Colby. And both Colby and John Paul II, I mean, it's inescapable that they were holy men facing a war, not just the Freemasons, but, you know, under the spectrum of fascism, and just outright violent hostility toward religion and atheism. And I think, you know, I'm not going to paraphrase this correctly, but I remember someone saying, you know, it's not enough that evil exists in the world, but it has to masquerade as good. And right. So to say that, well, Ma, you should really unhook Mom from the tubes because she would have wanted that, and it's the compassionate choice. Well, you don't know that, and you can't know that. And a lot of it, I think, is because life has become so expendable at both ends of the continuum that is what is suffusing the decision-making. It's not theology. It's not morality. It's not bioethics. It's not law. It's I have this feeling of misguided compassion, but it's basically totally subsumed into this is going to be inconvenient or icky for me, so it is more expedient simply to end this life than deal with it. You know, and I think the other thing that I remember reading this at least a decade ago, but I think it was John Paul that wrote, you know, suffering isn't necessarily all bad. You know, there's this conception that, you know, as soon as you have a boo-boo or a scratch or a headache, you have to just medicate it away. And I think that, you know, John Paul's example, when he, you know, he was one of the youngest, if not the youngest popes to take over, but he, you know, at the end of his life, he was in a lot of pain and suffering, and he really dedicated the end of his life to being that living example of the value and the beauty of life, and that suffering can also be ennobling. You know, so I think, and just divorce, I mean, again, being a lawyer and playing the cross-examination card, I remember when I was at Yale, there was a bioethics and law class, and you can imagine how popular my views were.
Wow.
in that, you know, with how dare you be pro-life. But I remember distinctly our professor was very fair. He was a guy named Bo Burt. He was a Supreme Court clerk, published 1,000 articles. But we did... you know, we did a video, a documentary called Please Let Me Die. And it was about a young guy in Texas, football player, got in an oil derrick explosion, was burned over 90% of his body, was in this agonizing pain. and would just, you'd hear this plaintive cry, please let me die, please let me die, please let me die. And he, you know, your heart went out. And just to cut to the chase, you know, he had the skin grafts, he went through, he came out the other side, he realized, you know, he was glad that his life was not taken from him. He eventually got married, had a family of his own.
Wow.
You know, it's not so much, I don't say that as much for the neat Hollywood ending as that choosing the finality of that, similarly to abortion, wipes away every other option that's on the table. And the point I was trying to make about my professor, he said, you know, the reason there's confusion is that a lot of people love to concatenate confusion with these emotional directives. And he said, especially with modern medicine, there's really no need for this picture that you're in this agonizing, crippling, terminal suffering all the time, and that you're, you know, your whole life, essentially, you're in the inferno. He said, you know, with pain medication and with other palliative measures, that little trope doesn't really have any moral weight or significance. Added to which, you know, again, this whole theory that if I suffer at all an iota, this is ipso facto a bad thing. I mean, you know, especially as we enter the season of Lent, I mean, Christ, I was just reading the other day, actually, the passion, you know, everyone thinks about passion as just this wildfire emotion, but there's a German word for passion, which said an enjoyment of suffering, that there is something ennobling about suffering. And there's a reason why we go through the passion and, you know, each season, and we commemorate that at Lent and on Good Friday. You know, and I think that there are a lot of lessons. Again, PHL is not, you know, is non-denominational in theory, but I think that there are a lot of lessons that can be learned within the schools from the theology, and I try to integrate that occasionally into the lecture to kind of give, you know, pour new wine into old class in a new casks for the kids so that they can understand the message more. But again, I think that there, you know, it's kind of half-baked logic, and these nakedly would-be emotional appeals confuse the issue even further.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Convenience has become a rationalization, a powerful rationalization, animating the pro-death drive in America. And why wouldn't it at the other end of the continuum be a factor, as you say? Why wouldn't convenience, meaning this loved one of mine is going to be quite a burden for me, even you know, in hospice or even in whatever care is eventually we find for her or for him. Let's just see if we can get all of that taken care of. And opting for this simple, horrible, painful, tragic ending. It's a slow Terry Schiavo-like death, the way it's written up. It's just hard.
Yeah, and I think the reality, too, is when you go through it, and I mean, I again, going back to the example of my uncle, he's more or less kind of a shut-in. He, you know, he basically has his meals brought to him. He's not very mobile, you know, can't drive. But, you know, it's interesting that since he's been in that condition, I try to visit him once a week and deliver him communion. And it's something that, you know, he really appreciates. And, you know, not to, again, you know, give myself extensive hagiography, but it's been an opportunity for me and for him, you know, to talk about family history. Or, you know, I remember a couple weeks ago when we had those 70-degree days, you know, he said, can we go outside? You know, and you don't realize that, you know, as enfeebled as he is, and he's basically almost confined to a wheelchair, you know, just having 15 minutes outside just lit his eyes up, and he took so much enjoyment from that. And he knows that he, I mean, he's still lucid. He knows, you know, his horizons have been narrowed significantly, and he can't do all the things that he could once do. But I remembered it, you know, the proof in the pudding, at his birthday earlier this summer, you know, for all that has been taken away and for all the suffering he's going through, his birthday wish was, I would love to be here next year.
Wow.
You know, and you hear things like that, and he said, well, you know, he certainly doesn't want people making decisions for him.
right,
to abridge that lifespan. And who are we to say what, you know, quality of life really involves, or to arrogate that decision for ourselves for, you know, as we've talked about, convenience, or I would say kind of a misguided compassion. You know, the proof in the pudding is, you know, getting education and having interaction with people who are in this position to get their take on it.
What's his name? We'll have our listeners pray for him, and I'll pray for him too.
His name's John DeFrancesco.
We will pray for John DeFrancesco, and we ask all our listeners to do the same. Tough time in his life.
Thank you, Brian.
And before I forget, because I will forget, Chris, tell us and our listeners how we can contribute to Pennsylvania for Human Life, and those who are listening who might want to be speakers in high schools and elsewhere, how they can get in touch with the organization and Martha Short and get a shot at doing that.
Well, I would encourage a two-step, given that everything is now in the information age. You can go on our website to learn more about us. That is www.pennlife, P-E-N-N-L-I-F-E, one word, .org. And you can learn about our history, where we go, our officers, how long we've been around, and so forth. People who are interested, like Brian, in becoming a speaker, or in donating, we just started our Quebec raffle. It's an all-expense-paid trip for two, including tours and all meals. That's our annual raffle that'll be drawn in October at our luncheon. That's one of our initiatives. But, yeah, if you want to get involved, go on the website. Again, that's www.pennlife.org. Or give me a call. I'll give out my cell phone number. How about that? 610-731-5387.
That's pretty good. Say that again.
Cell phone, 610-731-5387. Anyone who's interested, I'd love to talk to you, and I can put you in touch with Martha.
Well, we encourage our listeners to make that phone call, but no solicitations, okay? I want to get back to something that Dr. George Isaias said, that in the context of suffering and reparative suffering, as you were making reference to. He said, you know, it's not just the good, that the suffering that is cut off by the bestial decision to consign this loved one to a horrible, painful, tragic end of life without food and water. Totally unnecessary. Just a confused decision. It's not just a matter of denying the suffering, the good of it, and the power of it for that particular soul, but for other souls as well who depend on it. And he went then one step further. It was really a sublime argument. He said, you know, the end of life and suffering at the end of life very often is purgative. And he said, you know, most of us are going to have to be purged in purgatory for some period of time, obviously, because we can't quite make full reparative redemption, if you will, for all the falls and sins and things like that that we've done and committed throughout our lives. And what you, and one of the saints, a number of the saints have said that a day's worth of suffering here is equal to about 10 years of suffering in the next life. So by denying, his argument is, that soul a chance to suffer at the end of their life. And you're really denying them, you're consigning them to what would be an unnecessarily protracted purgation in the next life. And I thought, what a fascinating argument that is. And it's true. It's theologically solid. It's, you know, this is what the church teaches. And it reminds you of something that Pope Pius XII said in one of his encyclicals, which I thought was maybe the most extraordinary statement I've ever heard or read in an encyclical. It was Mystici Corporis, the body of Christ. And he said, you know, it's a great mystery that the salvation of the many depends on the holiness of the few. And to your point, Chris, the way to achieve holiness, and John Paul II made reference to this often, at the end of our life by accepting suffering as he did with dignity and grace. We come to a full interior maturity, and we show the nobility of the human spirit, and we take giant strides through grace to holiness. And that holiness is what ultimately is salvific for many, many, many other souls that we will not see, know, or have any idea of until the next life. It's really sublime, isn't it?
That is extraordinarily eloquently put, Brian, really puts the button on it. That, like, just again the example of my uncle, you know, just saying his rosary and giving him communion and acknowledging that, you know, he's kind of at the end of the road, but he can meet this with dignity. I mean, it's kind of funny too that you think the death with dignity folks would be all about denying those opportunities, as you said, right? That there can't be any dignity in quietly accepting your fate with courage and with faith, and when you're at peace and doing these, you know, kind of, you might be physically enfeebled, but your mind is still there, your heart and your spirit is still able to pray for others and to work these really, as you said, purgative and really transformative works of mercy, you know, from a wheelchair. And I think that, again, that's the presumption, is that you can only have a quote-unquote dignified death by abridging it prematurely, which to me, again, you know, I think as you were talking about, you know, the doctor who deals with these issues, Dr. George, you know, that just inverts it, you know. The ennobling quality of the end of life, you've actually deprived the person of all of those opportunities by presuming that the only dignity is in shortchanging or subverting what is really an opportunity for grace.
And as you point out, often for a very selfish reason, a reason of pure convenience, which I can't imagine having to give an accounting for. But what a wonderful treat it's been, Chris, to have you with us for this hour and to learn more about your terrific organization, Pennsylvania's for Human Life. It's just a great, great gift to this area and to our young people in our schools that are so confused and assaulted by all these signals, as you put it, that they get from the death culture. I just commend you for your work. I ask our listeners to please support it in the ways that you identified, even to the point of taking personal calls on your cell phone. So, Chris, we're very, very grateful, and if there's anything else that In His Sign Network can be doing to support your wonderful work and your organization, will you please tell us?
Absolutely, and I really appreciate, on behalf of my board and Pennsylvania Human Life, I really appreciate the opportunity that you've given for me today, Brian, and the support that you've shown our organization.
Well, you're quite welcome, and I'll ask all our listeners to pray for the organization. And keep in mind, this is the 100th year, the anniversary of Fatima, a great, great event in the history of our time and in our church. And let us all pray the rosary, as Our Lady asked us to, in honor of Our Lady of Fatima, because she said that if we did, the triumph of her Immaculate Heart would be realized in this age. And I can't think of a better thing that we could do for our children and grandchildren. Thanks for being with us today on Our Recourse and In His Sign Network, and hopefully we'll see you next week.